You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
And welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today. We will be here soon with Steve Gradonis. We're having a little bit of technical trouble here, but we should have him on the phone in just a minute, or connected in through Skype in just a minute. So today is the National Day for the March on Washington, D.C., the Respect Life March. This happens every year around the anniversary of Roe v. Wade. They moved it to this Friday. The actual anniversary is January 22nd. I actually remember when this happened. It was in 1973, and even at that time, I was a freshman in high school. But even at that time, I recognized that this was bad. You don't kill unborn children, and I've always have been pro-life as a result of that. So I was one of those people who was pro-life long before I was a Christian, long before I was a Catholic, it's just always been something that I believed. And I've never seen any reason to waver in that commitment. It has always been obvious to me that human life is to be protected from conception to natural death. And that's just what we should do. And so this was one of those issues where the church's I took to the church's teaching on this like a duck to water. The church has always taught this, and it's just been something I've always believed. The main thing that's being protested today, of course, is that Supreme Court decision. The official position of the United States ever since then, which has said that, well, it's waffled back and forth. I mean, the Roe decision itself said if there's a person there, then obviously then this is not something that we can do. And it went about trying to explain away the reality that there's a human person there. What we're talking about, of course, is a metaphysical question. Oh, I'm hearing my voice bounce back to me now. Is that Steve there?
Oh, I am here.
You are there. Okay. Hello.
I am. Hello.
And welcome.
I hope the bounce back isn't too bad.
No, it's all fine now. Voice that you hear there is Deacon Stephen Gradonis. He is my Friday co-host. And I was just talking about the March for Life that's going on in Washington right now. I'm out in the other Washington, and we had our March for Life on Monday down at our state capitol in Olympia.
And yes, that is usually when we would have done it as well, but due to the inauguration and then the other big march in Washington, D.C. that happened on Monday.
Right. Wait. On Monday, there was the Women's March on Saturday.
And that was Saturday?
Yeah, it was a Saturday. That was the day after the inauguration.
Okay.
And, I just figure, you know, it's got to be just an absolute nightmare to work in Washington, D.C. this time of year. Especially this year. I mean, there's the inauguration and then the Women's March and then then a couple of days go by and it's the Pro-Life March and it's like, I would just like stay home from work for a week or something, you know, while all this traffic was going on. But so I was just saying that I have always been pro-life. Long before I was a Christian, I was pro-life because it's always been obvious to me that all the sort of fine parsing of, you know, when is a fetus a person, it always just seemed like complete baloney to me to to try and make those kinds of shades of distinctions. And and the great thing that the advance of medical science has done is just make those arguments harder for pro-abortion people to make.
Although some of them are still in their gamely trying to make them.
Oh, they're still working at it. Yeah, you know. Well, and that's the, you know, one of the great ironies for me after becoming a Christian was, you know, for years and years, I heard things like, you know, Christians are obscurantists who just, they're afraid to follow the evidence wherever it leads. And, you know, the more science advances, the more their, you know, belief in the supernatural and so forth is in retreat and so on. And then, you know, when it comes to questions about abortion, you know, it's the Christians who are saying, look, 46 chromosomes, you need more evidence? Here's an ultrasound. Look, you know. And meanwhile, it's the supporters of abortion who are like getting all super mystical and fuzzy about, you know, when does the soul enter the body and all this stuff. And and you know, Christians are just going, just look at the science. And there's you know, so one of my favorite signs from last year was the Atheists for Life sign. There is such a thing as Atheists for Life. And the Atheists for Life sign just said, "For the embryology textbook tells me so."
Yes.
So I thought that was fantastic. And but
I don't know if you've followed at all the flack over the piece on ultrasounds that ran in the Atlantic this week.
I saw a bit about that article, and it seemed to me to be so obviously desperate that I kind of just didn't bother with it.
It was really crazy, and the social media world and the Catholic media world just absolutely went into convulsions over this thing. Mm-hmm. There was an article in the Atlantic, the original headline of the piece was "How the Ultrasound Pushed the Idea That the Fetus is a Person."
That was what I mean. When I saw that, I thought, that's like saying how, you know, how the telescope pushed the idea that the moon is round. I mean,
yes,
of course it did, well, you know?
So what she went on to do in the piece was to engage in, you know, a combination of a bunch of different strategies. You know, she pointed to pro-life efforts to use ultrasound and to use other science around fetal development to, in some cases, you know, create potentially legitimately misleading impressions. You know, this is something that, you know, pro-lifers have not always given a true sense of scale as to how large the fetus is at different developmental points and stuff like that. But she also tried to argue that the fetus does not actually have a heartbeat. And that this is, she literally wrote the sentence, "The technology has been used to create an imaginary heartbeat." Heartbeat in scare quotes. I'm not making this up.
That was, yeah, I know. And they say we're ignorant of science. That's hilarious.
So that sentence was deleted from the piece after after much
derision.
Yeah. But there was no somebody said, I think on Twitter or on Facebook or something, somebody said that the Atlantic retracted the imaginary heart. Well, no, they didn't exactly. If you just delete it without acknowledgement, that's not really a retraction, is it?
It's called flushing it down the memory hole.
Yes. So it does highlight the importance of the principle that as pro-lifers, we need to be scrupulously honest about what the science says and doesn't say, and not to push past, you know, like, for example, with regard to the whole question of when is a fetus capable of feeling pain? And this is an issue where, obviously, you know, getting science untouched by politics is going to be impossible. Everybody is going to have an agenda here. And of course, we can't really know when the fetus is capable of feeling pain. And we can, you know, we can argue that the fetus is capable of responding to stimuli at a certain point and that, you know, it's capable of stress responses. But does it have the cognitive capability of saying that that's pain? You know, this is we can point toward evidence that suggests that the fetus may well be capable of feeling pain by a certain number of weeks, and that, you know, you're going to get a lot of pushback from the other direction. But sure, we need to be as honest as we can in saying this is what we can say, you know, and not try to go beyond that.
Well, and of course, that whole question presupposes that the ability to feel pain means something significant. I mean, in certain states, you and I are feeling no pain, as it were, somebody can get drunk enough or drugged enough, including, you know, Novocaine enough, you know, so what? Those kinds of questions obtain as well. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. We're talking about the March for Life. That's the big thing in the news today. This is the last big, massive gathering of people in Washington, D.C. for the foreseeable future. Not sure when the next march for something or other is supposed to happen, but this is the last big one for now. And there's, as ever, with the pro-life movement, there are all kinds of fascinating political and cultural riptides that attend it. You ran across something today. What was it? The gay vegan atheist?
Yes. Yes. There was a piece that ran in the Washington Post. It was by a journalist named Sarah Pulliam Bailey, who I had a chance to I met her, actually. We were mutual follows on Twitter, but I met her in Philadelphia when Pope Francis was in town. We were just we were both standing on the press standee, and we were kind of talking to each other. All of a sudden, we're like, oh, wait a minute, I know who you are. So she tweeted it. The piece wasn't by her. She tweeted it, but it ran in the Washington Post. And it was about a woman, 20-year-old woman named Rosemary Garati, who is a bisexual vegan atheist at the March for Life. And, you know, I love examples like this that, you know, shatter the narrative around what is pro-life, because of course we're all supposed to be like older white Christian men.
And,
but I especially because I've been to the March for Life many times, and you know, the thought of somebody who fits that description going to the March for Life fills me with such joy, and really just, you know, it would make me want to, you know, give her a hug if I could, because she must very often feel really awkward and uncomfortable there, because the, even though there are many people at the March for Life who are not Christian and who are not Republican and who don't fit the stereotype, the event itself does have this character to it. It is very Christian,
right,
as an event. Many of the speakers are Christian. Many of them are religious figures and religious leaders. They talk about Jesus. They talk about Christianity. A lot of the groups are their church groups. They're groups from Christian schools, Catholic schools, Protestant schools. And there is this so there's this overwhelming cultural flavor. And if you don't fit that flavor, then, you know, to go there as an atheist, to go there as, you know, a gay person,
it's foreign territory.
It is.
Yeah.
And I have, you know, I know what it's like to be one person in a group of people who are very different. And, you know, but not in, not to anything like that magnitude. So, you know, my hat is off to all of the people who don't fit the narrative, who don't fit the profile, but who recognizes, and you know, many of them do. Did we talk on this show? Did we talk about Nat Hentoff when he died?
We didn't really talk about Nat Hentoff, and he was one of my heroes. I have tremendous respect for anybody who will step out of their comfort zone and go and cross the aisle and talk to people that are not like them. I think that it's a deeply Catholic instinct to do that, and that it's it always takes courage. And Nat Hentoff was one of those guys that did that. For those of you who are not familiar with Nat Hentoff, he was an essayist for the Village Voice. He described himself as a Jewish atheist. He wrote a lot. He wrote tons on American jazz, and he also was pro-life. When the whole subculture that he lived and moved and worked in just hated pro-life people, and he very courageously took their part.
And I want to say something to that position, because, you know, you and I, as theists and as Christians and as Catholics, we are very comfortable using what has been called the moral argument for God.
Right.
And from our perspective, there is a rock solid argument to be made that without a transcendent reality, without an ultimate ground of being in which our moral principles and absolutes can be predicated and can be rooted, ultimately there is no such thing as a transcendent or absolute ought. Mm-hmm. There are no moral absolutes.
Right.
You know, and that's not to say that nobody's going to do things out of conscience or out of moral considerations, because, you know, we still feel the way that we do about right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you do something good and you have this warm feeling inside. You do something bad and you feel bad inside. And, you know, everybody wants to be liked and accepted by others. And if we were to just go around being cruel, we would become ostracized, and that would be bad for us. And we wouldn't, you know, it makes sense for people to act in ways that are generally socially approved, in ways that they feel like acting. And yeah. I have a lot of respect for the position of somebody like Penn Jillette, who said, you know, I've murdered and raped exactly as many people as I ever wanted to, which is zero.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he's an atheist, and that makes sense. But on the other hand, there are those moments where what you really want to do and what you feel you ought to do are in conflict with each other. So without exploring that whole argument, I just want to say be that as it may, there are countless atheists in the world who are committed to doing what they believe is the right thing to do. And if you have that point of view, and if you have the point of view that this life is all that there ever is, and when you die, that's the end, then to come to the position that to deprive anyone of that life is the greatest harm and the greatest wrong that you can do. There's a logic there.
Yeah, and it's why, you know, a lot of people forget, but one of the most famous and bitterest enemies of all religious belief anywhere at any time for any reason was Christopher Hitchens, who was also opposed to abortion. And for exactly that reason. I mean, you know, look, you only get one shot. Then we have to think very seriously about taking that shot away from anybody. And that included the unborn. And so he opposed abortion. And you know, I can, my attitude, you know, as a
Roger
Christian
Ebert
is,
was another.
Yeah. My attitude to all of that as a Christian is all hands on deck. You know, I don't care. Are you opposed to abortion? Great. Join the, you know, join the throng. You know, we can argue about your theism later. But here's the house is burning down. You got a bucket. Go ahead. Throw your water on it. And this is, you know, this was the stupidity of the Women's March last week. That's what really summed it up for me was this was the folly of, you know, the alleged point of the Women's March was the house is on fire. We all, you know, feminists all have to band together to stop this misogynist in the White House. So pro-life feminists showed up and said, great, we'd like to help. And they said, well, before you are allowed to throw water on the fire, there's this purity test that you have to pass. And the moment they did that was the moment they revealed that they don't really think the house is on fire. And that's the difference. You know, at the march today, pro-life feminists are welcome because there was no purity test on, you know, well, is your feminism something that I object to?
I do want to say this, though, about the March for Life on Saturday. Pro-life feminists were there, and they did join in the march. They were not told that they couldn't show up, but they were not allowed to be event sponsors and have their name be on the website.
Right. Well, of course, that would have been impossible for them to be told that they couldn't show up. It's a public space; they can go where they like and do what they want.
But I also want to say that there were many, many of the pro-life feminists who were there. Some of them had not so great experiences, but some of them also had very gratifying experiences. You know, pro-choicers who cheered when they saw them and they said, we may not agree with you, but we're happy you're here. And so that official position of unwelcoming from the orchestrators and the runners of the Women's March was by far not felt by every single pro-choice person who marched in that parade.
In that
demonstration.
Yeah, well, because I think a lot of the women there were smarter than the organizers and realized it is all hands on deck, and you know, don't be so picky about this. And that's really vital, and it's something that we need to also continue to embrace in the pro-life movement. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Stephen Gradonis, and we will be back on Breadbox Media right after this.
You are listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.
Hello, and welcome welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gardonis. We're talking about the March for Life in Washington, D.C. We Washingtonians were way ahead of the curve. We had our March for Life on Monday because we're so awesome and you guys are slow. But it's happening. And one of the things that, of course, the fact that you're having a March for Life in our nation's capital makes this nothing without politics. This is an intensely political march. It's about one of the great political issues that has split American political life for the last 44 years. And so it's bound, you know, sometimes you hear people say, we shouldn't politicize this. Well, too late, you know. it's deeply political. And it was made political today, of course. Something happened today, which is both good and bad. The good thing is, for the very first time, a political leader almost as high up in the executive branch as you can go, addressed the March for Life. Vice President Mike Pence spoke to the March for Life, and that's a step up in one way, because it's so often it's been you sort of get this phoned-in message, you know, from if there's a Republican in the White House, and you get this kind of phoned-in message of, yes, I notice you. No, I can't be bothered to come and talk to you.
Yes.
Kind of thing, you know, that has always been the case up until today. And today, the vice president actually took the trouble to, not the president, because he really doesn't care about this, but the vice president showed up and gave a talk. And so it's good that the state is noticing at that level. Unfortunately, the net effect of this, I think, is not going to be an overall win. And the reason for that is because the net effect of this, at the very moment that this speech is being given, yesterday, Trump issued an executive order that's one of the more sinister executive orders issued in American history. I don't think there's ever been anything like it in American history. The executive order is basically saying that, quote unquote, the ostensible reason we just want to educate people. But the executive order basically says we're going to start publishing a list of crimes committed by immigrants. There seems to be no distinction between legal and illegal immigrants. It's simply, here are immigrants and here are crimes committed by them. And this was done before. This was the same thing was done by the Nazi regime. They picked out crimes committed by Jews. And would,
is that right?
Yes, and
I was not aware of this.
Yes, they would publish lists of crimes committed by Jews, and the purpose of it, of course, was to instill in the minds of the population, these people are criminals. Immigrant equals criminal. That's the effect that this will have, and that is what this president is doing now. So that's the first thing. The second thing that's happened just this week is that this president has now on several occasions, including in an interview with Sean Hannity, who is a Roman Catholic, never forget, dispenser of propaganda for this regime, gave an interview in which they talked about how great torture is, and we need to be torturing people. And the arguments that were being put forward were, suppose somebody kidnapped your daughter, wouldn't you use torture to, you know, get your daughter back? Well, the effect of that argument is twofold. First of all, of course, it's to legitimate torture abroad. But, you know, in the words of Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life, not every heel is in Iraq.
Germany.
Yeah, Germany and Japan, but in our case, in, you know, Iraq or, you know, in ISIS-occupied territory. Kidnapping happens right here in the United States. And the effect of that argument is to say that we should be using torture domestically as well as abroad. We should be using it against anyone that we suspect is guilty of a crime. And so what we're looking at is the groundwork being laid for the use of torture by our police, by domestic investigators of whatever sort for whatever crime.
Well, and if anyone thinks that that's, you know, possibly a little too paranoid or extreme, let's also remember that in that same interview, in the same interview where Trump is talking about torture, saying, you know, I think we need to fight fire with fire, and then kind of walking it back, well, I'm going to listen to my two advisors. And he's got one guy who's saying, yeah, no torture. And the other guy saying, eh, you know, it's not really torture if you waterboard.
Right.
In that same interview, talking about the crime rate in Chicago, he said repeatedly, well, maybe the police, they're being too politically correct. Maybe they're, you know, in other words, maybe they're treating criminals with kid gloves. Let's remember, right, you know, Chicago is where, you know, the police officers had like black sites where, you know, people would be disappeared to. And this is not a place where criminals have been treated with, right, with kid gloves.
Right. And so at this moment that this president is making these kinds of moves, We now get a speech to an audience of overwhelmingly of conservative pro-life Christians. What's the net effect of this? Well, I've already been told today, you know, how dare you, you know, rain on this parade. This has been such a great day. What a victory for us. Why are you always complaining about this administration? You know, let's look at how pro-life they are. And my response is, let's look at how pro-life they are. This is an administration that's calling for torture. This is an administration that is taking the initial steps that a fascist regime takes in order to scapegoat a population. And what are we as pro-lifers going to do about that? Because being pro-life is more than opposing abortion. And that's the question that arises.
We should also bear in mind that while I believe that Mike Pence is sincere and in his pro-life conviction, he's not somebody like Trump who's new to the cause. Mike Pence took the opportunity of speaking at the March for Life to wrap himself in the mantle of the pro-life movement, but also in the mantle of the Republican Party and in the mantle of Donald Trump.
Right.
You know, what he could have done, what I would have loved to see him do, would be to stand up there and address a crowd that includes many Republicans, but also some Democrats, many Christians, but also some atheists and agnostics, you know, people who are gay, people who are Democrats, people who are, you know, don't fit the profile, and say, you know, I just want to say that this cause is larger than any one party or than our administration. And whether you voted for us or not, I'm glad to see you here. You know,
yes,
whatever we're divided on, you know, we stand together in this.
Yeah.
And what he actually said is, and I'm looking at his remarks now on Deacon Greg Condra's blog. Mm-hmm. He talks about the historic election of a president who stands for a stronger America, a more prosperous America, and a president who I proudly say stands for the right to life, President Donald Trump. President Trump actually asked me to be with you here today. He asked me to thank you for your support, for your stand for life. So, you know, the implication is if you stand for life, you supported Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. He talked about Trump reinstating the Mexico City policy, mm-hmm, and his upcoming Supreme Court nominee. I'm glad he was there. I'm glad that he spoke. I'm uncomfortable with some aspects of his message.
Right. Yeah. And you know, what's always important for us to understand, you know, as pro-life Christians, is that Caesar – doesn't love you. Huh? Caesar is primarily interested in using you. And that's just kind of the nature of the relationship between Caesar and the church. It's always been that way. And so, you know, when we look at this, what we have to ask ourselves is, what do we seek? Are we seeking a sense that we have a place at the table of power, or are we seeking actual saved lives? The jury is still out on whether a single life is going to be saved by this president. We'll find out, you know. But until that happens, don't get excited about words. Pay attention to deeds. I'll be happy if he nominates a pro-life justice. That'll be great. But let's see what he does, and let's see if in 4 years anything has really changed. Because that's really going to be, you know, that's the measure, is whether things actually change. In the meantime, we got to watch what it is we wind up supporting in order to buy this guy's favor. And I'll talk about that a little bit when we return. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis, and we'll be back right after this.
If you enjoy listening to Mark Shea and all of his wonderful co-hosts here on Connecting the Dots, then consider becoming a friend of the show and provide your support today. Go to breadboxmedia.com and click on Friend of the Show. Thank you.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Deacon Stephen Gradonis. Just a couple of things that I want to note, and then we're going to move on to talk a little bit about the film Patterson. We started talking about it last week and wanted to finish that conversation. But for me, the thing that concerns me, and it's concerned me for months, has been the pattern that I've seen repeatedly, which is that as pro-life people, we start out by saying that the most important thing is abortion. That's what we have to focus on. It's the greatest moral issue of our time, et cetera. And I'm willing to grant all of that. Yes. I do think that it's the gravest moral issue of our time. But the paradox of the way that we then conduct the argument is we start by saying it's the most important moral issue of our time. Let's focus on that. But what we wind up doing so very often is, in fact, turning our focus away from it so that we can defend whatever it is the Republican leadership is doing right now. Because the theory is the Republicans are going to be the ones that help us. So we have to defend them. And what we wind up doing then is defending every culture of death priority that Republicans want. So right now, as I mentioned before the break, we've got a president who is now actively arguing, and he wouldn't be arguing for it if he's not planning to do it, is actively arguing for the reinstitution of the use of torture. This is something that the church says is a grave sin. You will wind up in a slightly different circle of hell than you will for actively supporting abortion, but you'll still wind up in hell for it if you don't repent of it. And that is what we're faced with now. And so what happens is the church says oppose torture as well as abortion. What we wind up doing is saying, well, abortion's a more serious sin than torture. Like, that makes torture okay. Or, you know, name your other thing that you want to have happen, that the right is telling you to resist the church about. And so, you know, whether it, you know, a lot of these things are prudential judgments, but nonetheless, they're things that are very much related to life. So the church says, you know what, let's get rid of the death penalty. There's no good reason for it. You've got two options at a moment like that. You can say, yep, and then get back to fighting abortion. Or you can say, well, the death penalty is a prudential judgment, and I think that the church is wrong, and I want to make sure that we spend a lot of time arguing with the church on why the church is wrong, because we need to be still executing criminals, and et cetera, et cetera. And you can spend a lot of time doing that, and guess what you're doing? You're not focusing on abortion anymore. You're focusing on fighting the church on this completely pointless, useless issue to fight the church over. And the same thing is going to happen with torture. And the way it's going to happen is this administration is going to push for it. And at that point, if you are a Trump-supporting pro-life Christian, you're going to have exactly the same choice. Are you going to go to bat fighting with the church to defend a sin that is every bit as worthy of the fires of hell as abortion, and thereby, of course, bringing scandal to the pro-life movement, as well as teaching people that they can fight the church on an issue of mortal sin? Or are you just going to agree with the church?
We have to be clear, too, what you mean when you say bring scandal on the pro-life movement, because the word scandal is used in more than one sense. And right. the way that you just used it is not the trivial modern sense.
No. Yeah. Scandal means, okay, most people, most moderns, when they hear the word scandal, they mean something that titillates and shocks. Brangelina broke up. It's a scandal. That's not
well,
a scandal.
Or, you know, somebody doing something genuinely bad and something that would be worthy of scandal in the proper sense. But what you mean is, oh, it's shocking and titillating. And
right,
it
right.
might lead to scandal in the other more technical
right.
sense. But
and the technical sense of scandal means to cause somebody to stumble in their obedience to Jesus Christ, to tempt them to commit a sin.
To give bad example.
To give bad example, exactly. And when pro-life people set out to defend something like torture, they are giving scandal. They are teaching people with a weak conscience that it is okay to defy the church on a matter of mortal sin. And that's bad.
It's bad.
It's bad for so many reasons. It's bad. But that is what this administration is asking pro-lifers to do. And the way they did it was by spending this week arguing for the use of torture and then sending Mike Pence out to speak to the March for Life today and say, we're with you and we are counting on your support. And they're going to get it. They're going to get a huge amount of support from people who really sincerely want to serve the pro-life cause, but have failed to make the connection between the fact that the sanctity of human life for the unborn is directly connected to the sanctity of human life of every other person from conception to natural death, including the prisoner, who you cannot torture. You can't do it. Ever, says the church. There is absolutely no excuse for it ever at any time. It is gravely and intrinsically immoral. And if you do it and you don't repent of it, you will go to hell for this. It cannot be emphasized enough that this is still the teaching of the church.
Oh, it's the teaching of the church is becoming stronger in this regard.
Oh, indeed. Yeah. Yeah. So that's, you know, that's just an example of what I'm talking about. And we're going to be faced with this throughout this administration. This administration is going to use the unborn as human shields for all kinds of other evils that it wants to do. But this is the example this week. And so as pro-life people, we need to, and this is the really crucial thing, we need to stop comparing our culture war allies, whoever they are, to our culture war enemies, and instead compare them with the gospel. That's the crucial thing. What, the moment you ask the question, who would Jesus torture? It answers itself. No one. Therefore, we can't. And that's really what it comes back to, is we have to start thinking in terms of the gospel, not in terms of, wow, Trump doesn't seem to me to be as bad as my hated culture war enemy at his worst. We got to stop doing that and start thinking in terms of the gospel. And now, end of sermon, let's move on to Patterson.
Something that I am very happy to do. Okay. Patterson is my number one film of 2016. It is in theaters now. You can go see it if you happen to live in a sufficiently large market where there's an art house theater that is likely to show a movie like Patterson. And if you do, and especially if you can bring a date, I promise you.
Okay.
I know I've already sold you, Mark.
I'm there.
Yes. So let me tell you about this film. First of all, it shares something in common, as I think we started to talk about it last time. It shares something in common with my number one film from 2015, which is that it is a winning and sweet love story that is set in and named for an urban area that is within, 15 miles or so from where I'm sitting right now, where I have been many, many times.
Uh-huh.
In 2015, it was Brooklyn. And in 2016, it is Patterson. And Patterson is a place where I went to school for 3 years. You will see in the movie, Patterson's nickname from of old is Silk City. And there are these large red brick silk mills that are historic in Patterson.
Wow.
It was a bustling, thriving textile town.
Okay.
And in 1977, one of those silk mills was taken over by a bunch of Christian educators, and it was turned into a school named Dawn Treader. And if you – yes.
Okay.
Yes.
That's cool.
And I was part of the inaugural class.
Oh.
Yeah, in 1977. Okay. I had been going to the Dutch Reform school system in this area, Eastern Christian. The school that I was going to closed. Mm-hmm. And some of the teachers were involved in creating – and if you go to dawntreaderschool.com, they're still there. And we were at number one Market Street. We were right off of the Great Falls of Patterson. And mm-hmm. a lot of the movie is set right around there. So it's got – For me, in addition to being a great film, it's got a lot of local and cultural significance.
Okay.
And so the protagonist of the film works near there. He works at the Patterson Bus Depot. And so we'll continue.
So it's Old Home Week.
Yes.
Well, I'm looking forward to it, and I'm going to take my sweetie to see it just because. I want to thank you so much for being on the show. You can see Cardonas. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we will be back on Monday with Sherry Antonetti. Until then, have a great evening. Oh, and thank you to Danny Head for being our producer. Have a lovely weekend. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media Podcast. Check out our live stream at breadboxmedia.com. Breadbox Media. Get the app, change the world.